today on Against the Grain, blacks in South Africa under apartheid, blacks in the U.S. performing Shakespeare. Athol Fugard has written about apartheid's impact on everyday life. L. Peter Callender currently stars in a production of one of Fugard's plays. I'm C.S. The veteran actor and director also discusses his efforts to get African Americans to engage with Shakespeare, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Race relations in this nation are troubled, even toxic. The South African playwright, Athol Fugard, has spent much of his life under apartheid. He's written about that toxic system not in formal political terms, but from the standpoint of someone interested in the everyday, the interpersonal, the emotional consequences of prejudice and racism. Athol Fugard, now 84, is one of L. Peter Callender's favorite playwrights. Callender has performed in a number of Fugard's plays, including Master Harold and the Boys, currently playing at Aurora Theater in Berkeley. Peter Callender is also artistic director of the African American Shakespeare Company, so he's thought a lot about racial dynamics and the situation of blacks and other people of color in the context of both theater and everyday life. Callender is a veteran actor, director, and writer. He's appeared in roles both on and off Broadway and internationally. When Peter joined me in studio, I asked him whether Master Harold and the Boys, a play about the apartheid-era relationship between a white teenage boy and two black servants of the boy's parents, whether the play constitutes a polemic, a frontal attack on the apartheid system.
I think all of his plays are a political critique. I think he started his theater as they're all very political theater. The Serpent Players were a bunch of ragtag actors. As a matter of fact, some of them weren't even actors. They just wanted to work with Fugard. So all of his plays have that political stint to them, the political colors, the political undertones. John Connie, Winston Shona, Zakes McKay, they were all underground political activists back in the 60s. So their desires were to find a voice for themselves, whether it was legal or illegal. As a matter of fact, when Fugard was working on these plays, the early plays, John Connie had never met him. John Connie, who became one of his collaborators with Sizwe Banzi Is Dead and The Island, hadn't even met him. And when they did meet, John Connie wanted to be an actor. And as a matter of fact, Fugard was like, no, what are you talking about? You're black in South Africa. You can't. And of course, John Connie and those guys, they had no relationships with white people. None at all. As a matter of fact, those guys thought that white people, if they were not in uniform, they were still police. They didn't trust them. So when the company was formed and these actors became actors with the company, it was all very political to get these plays out in the open. Most of them were banned. Most of them were, the police were everywhere, always in the audience. So they were very suspicious of everybody. But these plays had to be written and they had to be performed. So he doesn't necessarily write to say that polemic, fist up in the air, hatred of apartheid. He basically writes for audiences' self-examination. He wants them to listen to the play, examine their own racism, their own way of thinking about black-white situation, their own way of thinking about apartheid, their own way of thinking about South Africa. And he wanted them to witness something that goes on in the world of South Africa, in the world of apartheid. And hopefully, in listening to that and witnessing it, you may go out and do something about it, take some action. But he never says in his plays, do this, take action.
So it's a critique on a personal, on an interpersonal level.
Correct.
And how good was he at doing that in terms of saying something about apartheid in connection with and its influence on everyday life, as opposed to maybe, the broader political situation?
Mm-hmm. Brilliant. we are only seeing, and forgive me if I don't know of many other South African playwrights, I'm sure there are several who are doing great work around the world and certainly around the country, their country and ours. But Fugard is the one that was first. He came out with these plays, and he was actually quite good at it and still is. Fugard was a genius at it. And writing plays and writing characters that are brilliantly sculpted, real people in real situations that astound, that astonish, that surprise, that engage audiences. And he never thought that audiences should just sit back in the dark. He wanted them to be active. He wanted the actors to be clear on what they're doing. That's why he also directs his own plays and acts in his own plays. He wanted the audience to be participators, not just sitting in the dark. As a matter of fact, he tells a story about a performance of Sizwe Banzi Is Dead back in South Africa. If you don't know it, it's about Sizwe Banzi is a black man who is out of the township and he wants to burn his name. He wants to get rid of his name and call himself something else. Actually, I think the name that he picked was Robert Zwenzela something. Anyway, in that particular play, there's a scene where he's actually talking about ripping up the passbook. And the audience was so taken by it that a lot of people left, got up and left because they knew the police were outside. There was these two black men talking about something that was communistic, was illegal, tearing up your passbook. You know, it was so real to the audience that some of them got up in fear. And when they realized that it was a play and it was okay, they sort of came back in very, very slowly. But that's how active, and that's what Fugard really loves, is getting the audience involved and getting them to know that, yes, we are talking about their lives, and he will be sharing these stories with the world.
Well, this play, Master Harold and the Boys, now at Aurora Theater in Berkeley, it was written in the early 1980s. It actually premiered in 1982. It was the first of Fugard's play to premiere outside his home country, South Africa, where it was initially banned. You know, I mean, this is remarkable, isn't it? This playwright who engages with, as you said, a lot of black actors, a lot of fledgling black actors and performers who didn't want to have anything to do with whites, and in fact, in many situations, really couldn't really associate with whites. They needed their passbook to go into white areas. Talk about kind of the risks that were involved in Fugard writing these plays, associating with the people he did. And to my mind, and maybe to other people's minds, it sounds improbable that someone like him could actually have his plays produced in South Africa, which he did.
Mm-hmm. Oh, he did, absolutely. And he talks a lot about the danger of playwriting in South Africa. He was always conscious of what was going on outside of the room. He performed in churches. He performed in community centers. There were times when the company was invited to a university, for example, in which there were all these caveats. For example, they could not use the bathroom. They could not come in the front door. They could not talk to the audience before or after the show. There were so many restrictions to them. And the actor said, you know what, Athol, we are not going to do this. We're not too many restrictions. And Athol told them, this is why we are here. We are usually performing for people who are activists, who know our work, who wants to see our work. These are people who have never seen our work. We need to be here, and we need to abide by these restrictions and trust that we will get our work seen and understood and appreciated. And one by one, the actors came back. They literally left. Some of them actually got on buses to leave. And one by one, they came back after thinking about what Fugard said. So yes, these plays, especially Master Harold and the Boys, certainly The Island, certainly Sizwe Banzi, these plays were banned. All of his works were banned because he was working with he was breaking the law. He was doing all, there had to be all kinds of new laws, new ways of getting around working with black actors in those days. And he found a way of doing that. As I said earlier, a lot of these, the police were everywhere. They were disruptive. They would find a way to shut them down. They would find a way to infiltrate. One of the best ways of infiltrating a group in South Africa in those days was to call someone an informer. If Zakes Mackay said that John Connie was an informer, then John Connie would disappear. So a lot of actors were sent to Robben Island because somebody said, oh, he's an informer. As a matter of fact, one of the first and earliest performances of the island was actually done in Robben Island by one of the actors that was put in jail. So he diligently knew all the restrictions, all the possibilities for arrest, but moved forward anyway with his works. And thank God he did, because now we have an amazing canon of work, which I have grown to love and appreciate over the years.
L. Peter Callender plays the role of Sam in Aurora Theatre Company's production of Master Harold and the Boys, a play by Athol Fugard, now at Aurora Theatre in Berkeley through July 31st. It's been extended through July 31st. The play, directed by Timothy Neer, also stars Andrew Heumann and Adrian Roberts. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So this play, Master Harold and the Boys, is set in the year 1950 in South Africa in a tea house in Port Elizabeth. That's a city on the southeastern tip of South Africa. What's significant about the year 1950?
One of the highlights that this play takes place in 1950 is that apartheid started 2 years before. So here is this relationship between Sam Samela and Master Harold, Master Halley, and which was actually Athol's first name, Harold. It's autobiographical. We can talk about that later.
Certainly. And Master Halley, again, he's a white teenage boy, mm-hmm. and he's the son of the parents who employ these two black servants in their tea room,
correct.
Willie and Sam. Okay.
Correct. And they've known each other for 10 years, right? So imagine this father-son relationship where Sam would make, Halley would come into his room and talk and read and tell stories, and Sam would make him a kite. Sam would go for walks with him. So Sam became, his father was alcoholic, his father was abusive, crippled in World War II. So his relationship with his father wasn't very good at all. So Sam became that surrogate father. So imagine this relationship over the years as a friendship. Certainly, yes, a black-white friendship, but a friendship nevertheless. And then one morning they wake up and Halley becomes Master Harold overnight because of the apartheid regime, because of the setting up of the apartheid laws. Sam continues calling him Halley. Sam is an older man. He raised Halley in a sense. So for him to go to call him Master Harold after all that time was just didn't sit well with him. But Willie, being younger and being not as connected as Sam, calls him Master Halley, or sometimes he actually calls him Master Harold. So that's one of the things that I think is remarkable, that this play takes place in 1950. Just imagine waking up and all these things, the whole world is different. I mean, and there are also lots of passbook laws were instituted. For example, and I'll share something with you and your audience. Although this is not mentioned in the play, it's not an important aspect in the play, the playwright didn't ask for it, the character speaks nothing about it, I asked Timothy Neer, our director, and the folks at Aurora, whom I love very, very much, to design me a passbook so that I can have that in my back pocket, because Sam and Willie would definitely have to have had that passbook in their pocket all the time. It's like walking around a different country if you don't have your passport with you. Things can go awry. So it was not mentioned in the play. It's not a design thing in the play, but I had them do it just for authenticity, to have that book in my back pocket. So this was all brand new. They had to carry a passbook. They could not go from one border town to another. The township laws were instituted. Population registration had to be taken care of. So all these new restrictions took place in 1950. And these men, they had no choice, but they had a job, and they had a good job, and they've had a job for a very long time. So Sam and Willie actually were very lucky to be where they were.
Now, you mentioned this play is autobiographical. So tell us about Harold, which is, again, you said Harold Athol Fugard was his real name. And here is this Master Harold called Halley by Sam. So what was Athol Fugard's young life like? What did his mother do that related to incidents we see in the play, scenes we see in the play?
Very, very similar. His father was an alcoholic. His father was abusive. His mother ran a tea room, exactly as Hallie mentioned. It is completely autobiographical. The event of the play, and how do I tell this without giving too much away? Fugard, as a young man, Harold, was very tortured, in a sense, not physically tortured, of course, but his parents, the word we call it now is dysfunctional. There was no fun in that dysfunctional place. And he talks about that very openly in one of the monologues that Hallie has in the play. One day, Sam and Hallie had an argument about something, whatever that was. And I think it could have been after the apartheid regime took place in 2 years before the play starts. So as Sam was leaving to go home, Hallie got on his bike and followed him and did something that a young boy who's hurt and privileged might do to a black man in South Africa, something very disrespectful. And I'll save that for the play. And Fugard, now in his 80s, has never gotten over that moment in his life, never gotten over the fact that he did this to this man who was his best friend, who was his father figure. Sam never overcame it. Sam never came back to the tea room. Sam didn't ballroom dance anymore. His entire life changed because of that one moment. You put him against apartheid, he can deal with that. You put him against 44 million blacks being controlled by 7 million whites, he can deal with that. That's a political thing. But when that kind of personal disrespect comes from a friend, a young man who he thought was a son to him, that shook him to the core. And Sam never overcame it, and neither did Athol Fugard. And he wrote this play in order to try to exorcise that demon from his soul. And he's still working on doing that.
We're going to talk not really about the end of the play because we don't want to give too much away. But what comes out at the beginning and at the midpoint of the play, I think, is that Sam has a vision of a world, of a different world. And in fact, Hallie, or Master Harold, also has a vision. Can you talk a little bit about those visions and the hope that they express, and it's probably Fugard's hope, about where South Africa could go, you know, at a time when apartheid was, when society was deep in apartheid?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's brilliant the way Fugard constructs the play. There's this young white 17-year-old kid who is tortured and is shackled in his own home, in his own mind, by in a dysfunctional home, in a place where he's not very happy at all. And he finds solace in Sam's room, talking with Sam and talking with Willie and playing games and flying kites. That gave him his freedom. Sam and Willie living in the world of apartheid, the destructive, again, also torturous, also psychologically beaten down in the world of apartheid. And yet they find ways of communicating through education, through reading, through mathematics, through English books, through helping Sam helping Willie with his homework, Hallie with his homework, talking about having great debates about religion and about social reform. And so they both have a wish to break away from their own internal shackles and their own internal sense of being put down. So they both create worlds. And Sam's thinking of a world without collision. Sam Samela, the real Sam Samela, was also a ballroom dancer. He took ballroom lessons and loved ballroom dancing. So the metaphor for Sam, and certainly through Fugard's writing, Sam is telling Hallie about how beautiful ballroom dancing is and how wonderful it is to be one of those couples on that dance floor. It's beautiful. And Hallie's like, no, Sam, it can't. It's not beautiful. It may be entertaining, but it's not beautiful. And Sam says, yes, it's beautiful. And he says, why? He says, to be one of the competitors on that dance floor is like being in a dream about a world where accidents don't happen. And Hallie gets it at that particular moment. It's a beautiful dream. And that's the dream that Sam wants. And I think all your listeners, if they just think about it for a second, to be in a world without collisions. You pick up a newspaper and you're reading about certain collisions, big collisions, all quote-unquote collisions happening all around the world. People are dying. People are, countries are clashing and collisions are happening all over the world. And Sam's idea is, if the world can be a dance floor in which everyone is dancing and the music is playing and everyone is moving in rhythm to the music, that's a beautiful world. It's a beautiful specter of existence. And I think that's Sam's world. And Sam convinces Hallie for a moment that that is a beautiful world to be in.
It's a very powerful metaphor, dance is, as freedom, as beauty, as pointing to something higher and better. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. And L. Peter Callender joins me in studio. He is an award-winning veteran actor who has appeared in roles both on and off Broadway and internationally. He's also a director and a writer, and he plays the role of Sam in Aurora Theatre Company's current production of Master Harold and the Boys, a play by Athol Fugard that's now at Aurora Theatre in Berkeley. Peter is also artistic director of the African American Shakespeare Company, and I'll ask him about that work a bit later this hour. There are major shifts in this play, shifts in tenor and tone and emotion. I wonder if you could talk about how good Fugard is at sort of charting and effecting these shifts, these sometimes abrupt breaks from what comes before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what makes this play brilliant in its simplicity and torturous and provocative in its depth. He starts the play with Sam and Willie on a little downtime at their work, and Willie is talking about, you know, he's getting it. He's getting the dance step. He's getting it. He's learning it. And of course, Sam, as teacher to Willie, and of course to Hallie as well. And Fugard sets it up at the very beginning. And we learn that Willie has a little violent tendency with his girlfriends. Sam admonishes him for that. So we know that Willie has his own problems outside of, and that's how Willie gets his frustration and his anxieties out. With Sam, it's ballroom dancing. That's how he lives in his world. Then Hallie comes in, and we instantly know, speaking of shifts, there's an instant shift when Hallie comes in, because here are these two men of equal status, in a sense. They're both black in South Africa, right? There's an equal status there. Sam may be more of the patriarch than Willie, but then as soon as Hallie comes in, there's a shift. Master Hallie, and there's a difference in the way Sam behaves, there's a difference in the way Willie behaves. Then what I call the first ripple of earthquake that the audience barely notices, but it's there. It's when Sam tells Hallie that his father is on his way home.
His father is at the hospital.
That's correct. And his mother is, it sounded to Sam that his mother is about to go get his father. That's, you know, when we talk about a tsunami, when we talk about the beginning of a tsunami that no one recognizes it, no one knows where it is, it's 40, 50 miles, 60, 70, 120 miles out to sea, and you don't see it. It's just a little tiny wave, but it's there, and it's happening, and you barely notice it. It's imperceptible until, of course, it reaches shore. Then it's completely devastating. Those are the tiny little shifts that Fugard puts in. So the one shift, Daddy's coming home. When? I don't know. But be sure of what you heard, Sam. I am sure. No, Sam, you can't be sure. That's the first shift. Then the second shift, phone rings. It's his mother. Third shift, the ballroom dance. So little bits and pieces. And Fugard says something in the play that the audience very seldom gets. And if you see the play again, you know what I mean. He has Hallie say, creating a relaxed atmosphere, which will change to one of tension and drama as the climax is approached. Because Sam is talking about the setting up of the competition, of the ballroom dance competition, when everything is going to be beautiful, everything is going to be lovely. And that's what he's doing with the play. He's setting up the audience to believe that, oh, yeah, this is wonderful. Look at these black people and white people getting along so beautifully. Oh my gosh, they're talking about history and math and science and all these wonderful topics. And then suddenly, everything comes to a stop. The phone rings. Hallie's father is at home. And then the proverbial blank hits the fan. And that's when we realize, oh my gosh, wow, it's not real. It is a very tense world. It is a very dangerous world. And I think Fugard intentionally makes it a very dangerous world suddenly. And the audience has to be aware of that, that anything can happen in this room at this particular time. And it almost does.
It's also a testament to the fact that, and you're a director, you're an actor, you've been involved in the theater for a long time, that you don't need a lot of scene changes or shifts in time to deliver a dramatic punch.
Absolutely not. And interesting you should say shifts in time. No, there are no scene changes in this play from beginning to end. 91 and a half minutes. It's basically one long scene in which Fugard brings these people's lives into the forefront and entertains and shocks and mortifies in a certain way the audience. But the shifts in time happen, again, almost subliminally. The play takes place within an hour and a half. The time from the time Hallie comes in to the end of the play is about an hour and a half, the time itself. And there are tiny shifts in which, and I don't want to give too much away, but there are tiny shifts in time in which Hallie reverts to this, to his father. We start with the fun of the past, the days of old. And then the shift in time happens when Hallie realizes what's going on in his real life, and he becomes this apartheid, young, apartheid, domineering young man instantly. That shift in time happens almost imperceptibly, but the audience knows something has happened. Hallie has either become what his father is or what every other white man in South Africa will become, now has permission to become. And that's the biggest shift in time that you'll see in the play.
So I read a number of reviews of this play, Master Harold and the Boys, now at Aurora Theatre Company in Berkeley. And a number of critics said, you know, this is an important play to see. It has great relevance to what's happening today in terms of racial justice and racial injustice. One critic, though, did say that she was struck by the fact that this play encourages viewers to congratulate themselves on how enlightened they are in terms of racial attitude and racial perception. And at this point in time, we don't really need people to congratulate themselves on being so enlightened. We need, in fact, for white folks, for example, to realize that there's still a lot of work to be done. Do you have any reaction to that?
I agree with the latter. I think there's a great deal of work to be done. The fact that we are doing this play in 2016, a play that was written in 1982, a play that takes place in 1950, and we are still dealing with racial issues in this country in the similar ways where acts of violence, acts of rudeness and racism is happening. This interview is going on right now, and outside those doors, there are people harming other people with just words and looks and trust issues. So we've not come very far, actually. And I don't necessarily feel, and I don't know if I think people congratulate themselves for being enlightened. I think this play says to people, you know what? This is what it was. Think on your own life. Think on when you get back on BART. Think of when you get back in your car, as you drive down University, as you drive down Shattuck or Addison, or you get on the freeway, 580, 880, whatever freeway you get on. Think of where you're going. Think of what will happen with you tomorrow. Think of the way you treated that person of color 2 days ago, 3 days ago. Think of your child at university. Think of your child going to school. How do you teach that child about that? And it just reminds us that we are still in a world where collisions do happen. And I don't think people are saying, I am really enlightened now. Thank you so much. This play reminds me of how wonderful I am. Certainly there are going to be people out there who think that. I share a story very briefly. I did Sizwe Banzi is Dead and The Island at Portland Stage Company 120 years ago. Beautiful play, as with all Fugard plays. The audiences love it. Standing ovations everywhere. And we did it, Sizwe Banzi is Dead, intermission, The Island. And we got standing ovations. You know, we leave the theater. We would leave the stage. The audience would continue to applaud. We'll come back in and take another bow. And because the actors were just in khaki shirt and shorts, there was not much changing of costume and get back into street clothes. And we had our heads shaved bald for the show because we were in Robben Island prison, and that was the norm. And as we left the theater, people were still in the audience and certainly still in the lobby and just filtering out onto the streets. So in 8 minutes from the time we took our curtain call to the time we were going through the lobby and out in the streets, we went from celebrated actors on stage to two black men in Portland, Maine at 10:30 at night. And I have never, talk about time shifts, I had never experienced anything like that thus far in my life, and certainly not since then. Yes, certain things in different ways. But to have 300 people applaud you, loving your work, and then 8 minutes later, you go from celebrity to two dangerous black men, in which women, white women, were clutching their purses, and men were getting in the way because, and they didn't recognize us. So people may feel somewhat enlightened, and I think there are enlightened. I think Sam says it in the play. He says, I reckon there are a few people who've got past just dreaming about it and are doing something real. So Fugard acknowledges that. There are people who are doing something real, but there are most of the people who are not. And hopefully this play will say, what can I do? How can I reexamine who I am? Where have I been? Where am I going tomorrow? What my beliefs are? And I think that's what he wishes audience to leave the theater with this from this play.
Peter Callender joins us in studio. He plays an important role, a key role, the role of Sam in a production of Master Harold and the Boys, a play by Athol Fugard. It's now at Aurora Theater in Berkeley through July 31st. We'll take a short break and then speak more with Peter. And we're going to shift gears because he also happens to be artistic director of the African American Shakespeare Company. And I want to talk with him about race and the Bard and a whole lot else. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. I'm joined in studio by L. Peter Callender. He has worked with all of the major theater companies in the Bay Area. He's an award-winning actor. He's also a director. He's appeared in a number of films as well. And again, we've been mentioning that he's a big part of Aurora Theater Company's production of Master Harold and the Boys. He's also artistic director of the African American Shakespeare Company. And, you know, a lot of people, Peter, would not associate African Americans with Shakespeare. They wouldn't think about blacks and Shakespeare together. Is that a lack of imagination, or is it something else?
It's both. It's yeah. You know, we were just talking about Fugard, and just one more quick thing, because we did say Shakespeare. Fugard, in his company with the Serpent Players, they did lots of Shakespeare. From Othello to Titus Andronicus. They did the Greeks. They loved Sophocles. He did lots of Antigone. So when people say, well, black actors doing Shakespeare, like Halle says in the play, what does a black man know about making a kite? Everyone has these misconstrued, these ideas that we are not allowed. We can't fly a kite. We don't know about those. That's a white person thing. We can't do ballet. That's a white person thing. We can't sing opera. That's a It is wrong. It is insensitive. It's ridiculous. I guess I can come up with some other phrases, but I won't. Look, I've been doing Shakespeare. I've done 27 of Shakespeare's plays over the years. I am very proud of the work that I have done on Shakespeare. I teach acting Shakespeare at Stanford University. I teach fundamentals of directing also down there. I've coached actors on Shakespeare over the years. It is one of the playwrights that I understand intrinsically. It's deep in my DNA. I love his work. I cherish the idea of doing a Shakespeare play. I want to do a Shakespeare play every year, whether it's plays that I've done before over and over again, which there are several. Some of the best actors that I have worked with on Shakespeare have been black actors and black actresses. There's something about the topic. There's something about Shakespeare as a political writer. There's something about Shakespeare as a race writer, certainly in Othello, certainly in Merchant of Venice, Midsummer Night's Dream, where one of the characters talk about because I am dark. He's written all these incredible plays that anyone that has an understanding about life, anyone that cares about life, should do. It's not a matter. It's not a white world as far as Shakespeare is concerned. I think I do it well. I think the people that I've worked with do it well. White, black, yellow, tall, short, Asian, it doesn't matter. I think it's just what comes from the heart with Shakespeare. And that's why, as artistic director of African American Shakespeare Company, I just want everyone to, Sherry Young, the executive director and founder, former ACT grad, she founded the theater in order that actors of color, not just African American, just actors of color in general, get the opportunity to do what other people, as you started this conversation by saying, other people say we should not or perhaps could not do. There was once a time that Alvin Ailey was told that black people in general can't do ballet. Well, you know, hello, Misty Copeland. Right? Mm-hmm. One of the greatest ballerinas in the world right now, and she's black. So there goes that.
Do you see the African American Shakespeare Company as being part of a genealogy, as following other previous efforts to bring African Americans to Shakespeare, whether it's in the realm of acting or viewing?
Let me say this. A man whose life I emulate, who was a great political mover and shaker in the world, Paul Robeson, in whom I share an historical footnote, as a matter of fact, a theatrical historical footnote, one of the greatest black Shakespeare actors. There's a wonderful book by Eric Hill called Shakespeare in Ebony. Beautiful book. I believe that's the title. Ira Aldridge, recently played by Carl Lumley, directed by Margot Hall, in a play called Red Velvet, done at San Francisco Shakes. He played Othello in London and was almost booed off the stage because he was a black actor playing Othello, which was uncalled for. It was, you know, white actors only played these roles.
How long ago was this about?
This is in the 30s, I believe. So their early leadership brought us to the point where we can say this: we can own Shakespeare. We can make it our own. We can tell these stories through our own eyes and tell them well, if not better, than other theater companies and other parts of the world. That we can take ownership of that. And I think Shakespeare would be very proud of that, because I do believe that Shakespeare, not I believe, it is a fact, that Shakespeare wrote most of his plays for the people. It was written certainly for the hierarchy in a certain extent because they were commissioned, but he wrote it for the people, and he wrote it for the time that these plays took place. There were contemporary audiences. So we should take Shakespeare and do them in our contemporary styles, because that's what Shakespeare did in his time. And I think there are many theater companies and many actors that have gone before us that we are saying, let's pick up the mantle at African American Shakespeare Company and highlight the fact that actors of color are capable, are knowledgeable, are excited about doing these works, and we can do it very, very well.
How much are you driven in what you want to do today and what you do today by the fact that you, as I've learned, you were the only African-American actor in many productions of classic plays in earlier years when you were an actor coming up?
I just want to give back. I had the great pleasure of being trained at the Juilliard School, the High School of Performing Arts. I studied in London. I studied with Tadashi Suzuki in Togomura, Japan. I have had the opportunity to work with some of the greatest directors that this country has produced in wonderful theaters across the country. And I want to take all that knowledge, all that work, all that learning, and give back to a lot of the young people that are coming up today. And it's something that means a lot to me. When I first came out to perform here in the Bay Area, my friend and colleague Tony Taccone brought me in to do Adolphus Cousins in Major Barbara. I was the only African-American member of that cast. There was one particular actor who didn't think that he thought actually that I might mess up his play. And so he would give me a hard time. It took him about 15 years or so, having seen me in another show, to come backstage to apologize. But yes, over the years, I had been the only actor in a company of white actors in classic plays. And I held my head high because I knew that my training was good. I knew that my artistic ability was strong, my desire was strong, and I knew that I belonged there. And that, again, is what the mission, the values of the African American Shakespeare Company. We want actors to know that you belong. You can carry this play. And I have been guided by that strength, knowing fully well that, yes, I am it. And when audiences come to the theater and they see me, they're going to see an actor who has done his work, an actor who is strong, determined, knows his craft, and is willing to take huge chances in order to certainly prove himself, but to let other actors know that, yes, you can do this.
L. Peter Callender joins us in studio. I'm CS. This is Against the Grain. He is artistic director of the African American Shakespeare Company. He's been an artistic associate at California Shakespeare Theater since 1994. He's a native of Trinidad in the West Indies. He came to the U.S. in 1969. And you, as you say, you enjoy working with young actors. You like to bring young actors in. You have said something like, you don't want young actors to think too much about the lines in Shakespeare's plays, but to say them. Can you elaborate on that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you look at a line of Shakespeare and you start thinking about, oh, my gosh, it looks so complicated. I don't know what those words mean. Why is that verb before this? And if you think about it too much, you will overthink it. You will look at it and think, I can't do this. But if you read it, and then you have someone say, this is what that line means, and then paraphrase it in the way you would speak, then say what Shakespeare wrote, then paraphrase it again, you will find that what Shakespeare wrote is exactly what you're thinking. So don't think about it too much. Just say it. It doesn't matter what the line is. It doesn't matter which character says it. Just find your truth in it. Find the meaning of it. Think what you mean and say what you mean, but don't think about the line itself. Think about the thought, the idea, the emotion that comes from that line. And then we as the audience will feel what you're feeling.
Can you understand, though, people's frustration? It's a frustration that I sometimes share, that Shakespeare is difficult to understand.
Of course. Of course, some people find Ibsen or Chekhov or the Greeks hard to understand. Of course, some people find Susan Laurie Parks hard to understand. I mean, and they are, because they're deep. It's deep thought. It's not just putting a pencil to paper. It's deep, complicated ideas and thoughts. And you have to open your mind to that. You can't just look at it. Look, you go to an art museum and you see a beautiful work of art. Some people look at it and say, I don't get it. Why are the eyes way down there? And why is the nose on the top of the... What? Ah, What's his name? Picasso? What? Picasso? What? That's ridiculous. But if you study it, you will learn the reason why he did that. Why? And it's the same with Shakespeare. Words are in different places, so you can't just say, "Well, I just don't get it and leave it alone." No, it's complicated. It's complex. Look at it, understand it, read it, draw it out, say it. Look up words. There's tons of scholarship out there. Dig it out. Find it. We at African American Shakespeare Company, and at most companies I've done Shakespeare, there's very little adding of words. There's cutting of Shakespeare. You have to cut Shakespeare. It's just some of the archaic phrases in our language may be difficult to understand. But we don't add words, and we may change scenes, but we never add our own words to simplify it. We never dumb down Shakespeare for anybody. We make sure that the actors understand completely. Example, we just did a production of Romeo and Juliet with age-appropriate actors, right? Romeo 16, Juliet 15. And we went to San Francisco School of the Arts. We went to the Oakland School of the Arts. We went to the French-American School, and we got actors of color to come in and audition for us. And we picked two Romeos, two Juliets, plus all the Tybalt. Everyone was young. And I sat with them for 10 days at a conference room, word for word, line by line, thought by thought. And one actor, after the fourth or fifth day, brought me to tears. Of course, I cry at open parking spaces in San Francisco. but he said to me, he says, "Mr. Callender, I think I've hit the jackpot." And there's a 15-year-old black kid talking about, "I love Shakespeare. I didn't understand this before. I didn't know what I was looking at. Now you're telling me, oh, this is what is, this is, oh, that's deep. Can I say it now? Can I say it now?" And that's what we want. We want that excitement to say, "Now I understand it. Oh, I want to say that. I want to say that." And when they, in rehearsals or even late performances, they were quoting Shakespeare. We went out to dinner after the cast party, and they were quoting Shakespeare. They'd never done that before. That fills me up. And that's why we are there as teachers, as directors, as movers and shakers, as a theater company that's struggling right now. And we can talk about that in a minute. But we are there to enlighten, to enhance the lives of audiences and kids. One young lady, after seeing a production of Twelfth Night, she went into a pocket and she gave me her lucky penny. She said, "I've been carrying around this penny for a long time. I don't have a lot of money, but I want you to have this because I understood Twelfth Night, and I want you to know that I understood, and I want to support your theater." She gave me her, I still have it. Mm. So, and she was a young Caucasian girl, and I thought to myself, that's why we are there.
Would you then, should, in your opinion, people read Shakespeare's plays?
Out loud.
Right, and study them before they go see them?
I would recommend, if you are going to see Midsummer Night's Dream, or Romeo and Juliet or Winter's Tale. We are doing Winter's Tale next year. Yes, I would recommend that you look up something. There are all kinds of scholarships on the internet. Type in the Winter's Tale. You're going to get a plethora of pages on Shakespeare's Winter's Tale. Look at it. Read the synopsis of the play. And then open up a PDF and look at the first few lines of the play. There's something called Shakespeare with No Fear Shakespeare. Look that up. See, one side of the page is Shakespeare, the other side is a translation, in a sense. Look that up. Find out a little bit about the play. Don't come in absolutely cold. You may go to, again, I refer to going to museums, to artwork. If you go to the De Young for an Escher or Picasso exhibit, you may want to look up those if you've never seen them before. Or you just may want to go and appreciate it but you have to read something about it. And I would recommend that. And then come in and enjoy it. Back in the old days at Cal Shakes, there were, and we always laughed at this, but people did it. The audience members would come in with the complete works of Shakespeare. Or they would come in with the play, the Arden version, or the Signet Classic, or the Pelican version. And they would sit there in the front row, or whichever row they're in, and as we were performing, they would be turning the pages and reading it with us.
Wow.
Right? And they would get a little perplexed because sometimes we would cut and trim and paste. And they would, oh my gosh, turning pages frantically, trying to find where we are. But that took place. Not as much anymore, but I'm sure it still happens elsewhere.
The African American Shakespeare Company, of which you are artistic director, is currently based at 762 Fulton Street in San Francisco. You said it's struggling.
Yeah, we are in a major transition right now. We are we're looking for a space. We have been at the Burial Clay Theater for about 9 years now. I became artistic director about 6 years, and it's in the African American Arts and Culture Complex. And it's under new leadership, and we are discovering that most of our time in the theater for our build, our tech, our rehearsals is being taken away from us in order that more organizations get to use the theater, which in a sense is a good thing, but we're being squeezed out a little bit because we can no longer produce. We usually do 4 shows a year. We bring in over 4,000 students to see the shows for free from around the Bay Area. That may have to stop. We hire over 100 artisans, designers, set designers, costume designers of color. We are trying to maintain that. We are currently looking for a home for the African American Shakespeare Company. We're looking in Oakland. We're looking in San Francisco. There are places that are interested in housing us temporarily, but we feel that we know we are one of the only producing theater companies in the region. Lorraine Hansberry, headed by my friend Stephen Anthony Jones, they are producing some works, but they are usually doing readings in different places. The African American Shakespeare Company is the only theater company that's doing what we do in the region. And there's a possibility that it might all come to an end. We do not want that to happen. We will find a space. The San Francisco Opera is helping us out. There's a theater in the Bay Theater in San Francisco that we're looking at. We're looking at the Strand on Mission, ACT Strand Theater. We're looking everywhere. We need to find a space that we can call our own, that we can continue to do the type of work that is so desperately needed. Look, people tell me, you know, Peter, you know, you're very talented, you're this, you're that, you could be anywhere in the country. Why are you in Oakland? Why are you in San Francisco? Why are you artistic director of this theater? I do it because I love theater. I do it because I love working with young people. I do it because the Bay Area is one of the greatest theater hubs in the country. That's why I'm here. And I do not wish this theater company or any other small theater company that's doing what they are doing or what we are doing to disappear. There are so many companies of folding in the Bay Area right now, and I do not want to be one of them. So we're working very, very hard. Sherry Young and I and our board, we are looking, and we're hoping that one day our phone would ring and somebody would say, I have a space for you. Or a donor would say, here's this amount of money, begin your capital campaign to build. That's what we're waiting for. In the meantime, we will produce wherever we will produce. It will be successful, and we will do a great job with it.
L. Peter Callender. He's artistic director of the African American Shakespeare Company, and you can see him on stage at Aurora Theater in Berkeley in a production of Athol Fugard's play Master Harold and the Boys, which runs through July 31st. We've put links to both Aurora Theater Company and to the African American Shakespeare Company on our website, againstthegrain.org. Peter, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for this opportunity.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said. And we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.